Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to Minta Ellison for the use of this facility. It's great to have Greg Gailey here tonight on such an important topic and such a current topic. I'll introduce him very briefly. Educated at the University of Queensland, an extensive career in business, primarily in the energy industry, also as CEO of Zinifex. But in more recent times, Mr. Gailey, of course, is President of the Business Council of Australia, and it's in that capacity that he's here tonight to talk about modelling success, designing an emissions trading scheme. Mr. Gailey, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Don't take the speech. Good evening, and it is a pleasure to be here. There was a cartoon in The Age yesterday, and it may well have been repeated in the Sydney Morning Herald, it may not have, and it was quite amusing, I must say, but it was a picture of the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister was in his dressing gown, and he had in one hand a bottle of medicine, and in the other hand a spoon. And in one corner of the room there was a very bedraggled-looking dog that was hanging over the side of his basket, looking quite sick, and the basket was stamped with the word manufacturing. And there was a bottle of medicine on the shelf called Tariff Review. So clearly the dog had had a dose of Tariff Review. There was a very large fat cat hiding behind a chair, and that was clearly the object of the Prime Minister's search. And he was clearly going to administer medicine to this cat as well. And the bottle of medicine was called climate change. And there was a caption along the top of the cartoon saying that the cat should not have sneered when the dog got his medicine. I'm telling you this cartoon because I think it kind of describes an attitude that exists, and it makes comparisons between two quite different issues. I mean, the removal of tariffs in Australia was largely about removing protection from industries which are not globally competitive in Australia. What climate change, or at least the assistance that the BCA is talking about, is temporary assistance for industries which are globally competitive. So it is a fundamentally different issue. And it also reinforces, I think, the sheer difficulty we see in getting a sensible and pragmatic debate about this subject. It is an incredibly complex issue, and one which I don't think is very well understood, certainly amongst the general community. It's interesting that there have been surveys which show that 70% of people surveyed wanted an emissions trading scheme. However, 50% of the 70 didn't know what an emissions trading scheme was. And I think that it reinforces the point that I'm making. In his report, Ross Garnaut actually described some aspects, particularly one of the issues I will talk about, the assistance to what we call emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries. And that's just a nice way of talking about industries that use a lot of energy and, generally speaking, either export their products out of Australia or compete with imports. He described their situation as a truly dreadful problem, and it is certainly a difficult issue. And I'd go one step further, and I'd describe climate change as a grisly political problem as well as a truly dreadful economic problem. And I'll come on to explain why I make that comment. The Business Council, though, in terms of the work that we've done, and I'll be using partly to illustrate some of the points tonight, has put this report into the public arena to facilitate the debate. I mean, that is our primary objective. We are trying to be cooperative and helpful. We actually support emissions trading, and we support Australia addressing the global challenge that climate change represents. And we are quite realistic, and we accept that business has to bear part of the burden of addressing climate change. And we also accept that as Australia does that, it's not all negatives. There are actually positives. There will be business opportunities arise out of the process of addressing climate change. The report we released this week is titled Modelling Success, and I'm not actually going to tell you a great deal about what's in the report. I'm going to use some of the information to illustrate the talk. But if any of you would like to read the report, it is freely available on the BCA website. The report, I think, has been well received. Certainly the government has taken note of it, and the government has told us that they see it as a very useful input into the discussion, and that's what it was intended to be. Now, when you come to the whole issue of climate change, quite frankly, we in business don't see ourselves as qualified to form a view as to whether climate change is real or not. I don't think that is even the issue that's on the table here. I believe that's government's role, and government has certainly come to the view, based on the weight of scientific evidence, that climate change and global warming is a problem, and that global warming is largely a result of the emission of carbon into the atmosphere. It is, however, a global problem. It's not just an Australian problem. Matter of fact, in reality, there isn't a great deal that Australia can do to solve this problem. As emissions go, we account for something like about 1.6% of global emissions. So in our own right, if we stopped emitting tomorrow, if that were in any way, shape or form conceivable, we could not solve the global problem. What I think Australia can do, we can do two things. One, we can get our own house in order, and that's perfectly appropriate for us to do, and I would commend that. But most importantly, we can be a role model for the world. If we as a nation want to be a first mover, and that's certainly where the government is, then we have the opportunity to show other countries that you can do it, and you can do it in a way that doesn't damage your economy. And that, to my mind, is the real prize that that we should be seeking. About a little over a month ago, the government released what they called a green paper. And a green paper is different to a white paper in the sense that it's a preliminary paper which doesn't necessarily contain firm views, but contains a number of ideas that the government is currently thinking about. And this was the first time the government actually laid out its initial thinking in relation to what an emissions trading scheme would look like. And it proposed a scheme which the government has called a carbon pollution reduction scheme, which is called CPRS for short. Now, the BCA fully supports the government's intention to implement a CPRS. So what exactly is this emissions trading scheme or CPRS designed to do? Well, it isn't all that complicated. As we generate energy in this country, and let's take the electricity sector as a prime example because it is in its own right the biggest single emitter of CO2, as we generate energy and use it, we create negative effects in the environment, which the scientists tell us is leading to global warming. In the price you pay for electricity, there is no element of the cost of that pollution that's created in the environment. It doesn't get costed into electricity. And therefore, when you're generating electricity and you're selling electricity, you're basically selling it below the real cost if you consider the cost of the emissions to the environment. So what a carbon price is designed to do is to say, I want you as an electricity generator to recognise the cost of that CO2 you're passing into the environment. And the way that that gets done in an emissions trading scheme is, if you're an electricity generator or anybody else that's emitting CO2, you have to buy a permit. You have to buy a permit for every tonne of CO2 that you pass to the environment, into the atmosphere. And the price of that permit reflects what it is believed to be the cost of that pollution. In some cases, where it isn't economic to capture or to sell you a permit, like for private motorists, it's not economic to try and collect from private motorists. In some instances, the oil companies, for instance, in that case, will buy the permit on behalf of the consumer, and they will then put the price of that permit onto the pump. So that's basically what we're talking about in an emissions trading scheme. It's not really much more complicated than that. There's a whole lot of wrinkles around how permits get traded and various things of that kind. But the essence is that the government will sell you a permit, and that permit will recognise the society cost of emitting carbon. Now, much of the debate and the issues that surround what's going on in discussion at the moment is who bears the cost of buying that permit and how much should that permit cost. And there are actually two quite distinct issues, and I think it's quite important that you separate them, because one's about the total quantum of the cost that we want to bear as a nation, and the other one is about how does the pie get carved up. Now, if we had a perfect world and we had a completely closed economy, if Australia didn't trade with anybody outside its shores, and if the government was of a mind to say, all the revenue I collect from selling permits, I'll actually give back. It could be a zero-sum game. You could actually implement this scheme without a real cost to the community, and all you'd be doing is changing the relative price of things. In other words, it might become more expensive for you to drive your car to take your annual holiday, so you may choose not to drive it and take it in DY or Bondi. And hence you will have reduced the amount of CO2 you put into the atmosphere. However, you're technically no worse off, because the whole money you've saved by going to Bondi you can spend on chocolates or something else. And that in essence would be how it would work if Australia were a totally closed economy in a perfect world. Now, the government has actually said it will return all of the money it collects by way of permits. However, this isn't a perfect world, and Australia does trade outside its borders. And there are a number of reasons why the amount of money that comes back will not equate to the amount of money that is collected. First of all, there's the issue of churn. And churn is just a very nice way of describing the fact that when I take money off you and give it back to you, a little bit gets lost along the way in the administrative costs of collecting it and returning it. And you see churn very clearly in things like taxes, where the government collects a certain amount of tax and gives some of it back by way of welfare payments. It costs money to collect, and it costs money to distribute. So a bit of it gets taken away in churn. The government has also said, and I believe rightly so, that it wants to encourage the development and application of low emission technologies. Many of the things that we will have in the future to generate our electricity, for instance, and emit less carbon, are very early technologies. Carbon sequestration, where you take the carbon and store it underground from coal-fired generation, solar, biomass, these are all very early in their technological development. So the government wants to take a bit of the money it collects and put it into research and development for those technologies. The government also has another issue in terms of the electricity generators, who will be one of the biggest sectors to make this transition to low emission technologies. They, as I'll come to explain in a moment, actually have quite a challenging task to do that. And the government has already accepted that it's going to have to provide some transitional assistance to the generators to make that move into low emission technology. So a bit more of the money has gone off to help the electricity generators. And then we come to the problem that Ross Garnaut described as a truly dreadful problem. The position of these companies which use a lot of energy but basically export most of the things they make. And because they export most of the things they make, or alternatively they sell domestically and compete with imports, they actually have great difficulty passing on the cost increases to their customers. And the government acknowledges that until there's a carbon price right across our trading arena, that you'll have to give them some assistance too. So you can already see the sums are adding up to diminish the amount of money that's available from this pool of selling permits. And I haven't incorporated into this yet another charge of some $1.5 billion that will be needed to offset the cost of carbon increase in the price of petrol, because the government has determined that it will cent for cent reduce the excise on petrol for every cent that's added to the price of carbon, so that consumers will not immediately see an increase in the price of petrol. Now, that's another amount of money that has to come from the sale of carbon permits. So why is it important if this money kind of gets taken out for all these other purposes? Well, it's important because the more money that goes into all of those, the less money there is to compensate the people in this room and the rest of the people in Australia, and particularly to compensate low-income earners, because the cost effect of the price in carbon is going to flow right through the economy. Most of the things you buy will be more expensive as a result of the price in carbon. The lights that light this room will cost more. Your electricity bill will go up. Petrol will go up, although that will be offset by the decision to pay some of the monies collected from permits. So that creates a problem, a political problem, and that's why I describe this as a grisly political difficulty. Because on one hand, the government needs money to compensate these other groups I've talked about, and I'll explain why it needs to do that, but also needs some money to help the consumers. And the reality is that these consumers are voters and apply too much pain to the voters, and they're probably not going to be particularly happy. So this is part of the real debate that this country needs to have. It needs to have a big debate about how much cost does it want to bear to be an early mover. And being an early mover is about how fast do you choose to move. You can be an early mover and you can do it relatively gently, and the issues are not all that great. You can be an early mover and move quite fast and with quite a high carbon price, and the cost is quite substantial. Now, what the BCA's report has largely done is tried to quantify and get some feel for the position of some of the people who are affected in the industrial sector. So we've looked in particular at these energy-intensive trade-exposed companies to try and understand what happens to them. Real companies. And this is the first time there has been any data available looking at real companies. So this, I think, and the government accepts, is a significant contribution to the debate. Now, when you look at this issue of these companies, what we did was we took 14 Australian companies, and we can't name the companies because this is extremely sensitive data, and those companies operate over 12 industry sectors. And we're pretty confident from the work we've done that the impact on these companies will be pretty well mirrored by other companies in the same industry sectors. One of the industry sectors is cement, and the cement company that participated in the study, we're pretty confident we'll see the same impact on other cement companies. Other companies which are in the group are things like aluminium, oil refining, cement, zinc, lead. There are a number of industry segments incorporated into this study. And the question that arises is how much assistance do you have to give these companies in order to compensate them during this period when they are not on a level playing field with their competitors. And this group of companies are very important to this country. They are a significant part of the Australian economy. They are about 50% of the value of Australia's exports. So we're not talking here about a small segment of the Australian business sector. And they are companies who, generally speaking, either export or compete with imported goods. And they employ about 1 in 10 Australians, or somewhere in the order, depending how you choose to draw the lines, somewhere in the order of 900,000 plus Australians. And often those jobs are in remote locations, in regional locations where there aren't a lot of alternatives if those companies in fact close their operations. Because they can't pass the cost on to their customers, they're going to have to bear the cost of whatever the carbon price is, unless the government gives some compensation. Now, the government fully recognises that that some compensation is required in these circumstances. Ross Garnaut did the same in his report. He fully accepts that you have to give these companies some compensation. Now, if you don't, and we looked initially what happens if you don't give these companies any compensation, and you choose to apply a carbon price of $20, which is a relatively modest carbon price, it's $40 roughly in Europe, then according to our calculations, a quarter of the 14 companies we used in the research would have no choice but to close. They would be cash negative. And you can't run a business that's losing cash. We then looked at, okay, that we understand, and the government accepts you have to compensate, so that's not going to happen. We then looked at what happens to those companies when you apply the compensation mechanism that the government has detailed in the Green Paper. And regrettably, it doesn't look all that much different. Rather than four of the companies closing, four of the 14, three of the 14 close. Four of them suffer what could only be described as very, very significant deterioration in their earnings. Somewhere between 30 and 60% of their earnings disappear. So those companies would have to do something quite fundamental to remain in business. And the rest of them have to take some pretty immediate action to deal with their situation. And it's highly unlikely that the majority of them, I wouldn't say all, but the majority of them will certainly not make new investments given the impact on their profitability. Now, part of that impact is due to the way the government has designed the scheme, and part of it is due to the absolute price of carbon. And if you look in our report, there's quite a lot of information on what you can do to the design of the scheme to improve that situation. And we put a number of recommendations forward to the government. Don't necessarily cost any more, depending what price of carbon you choose to put. At higher carbon prices, they will cost more, but at $20, we think roughly the same amount of assistance the government is offering would actually create a much less damaging situation if it was given in a different way. And I won't go into the details of that because I'd need half an hour alone to cover that issue. But what probably is more important is why bother? Why bother giving these companies any assistance at all anyway? After all, they are high emitters of CO2, and wouldn't we all be better off without them? And that's certainly one line of argument is frequently put. I would put the proposition to you that we should care. We should care about these companies. As I said, they account for over 50% of Australia's exports by value. And quite frankly, in this globe, you live by what you can sell to other people, so that's pretty important. They provide a lot of jobs, as I've already mentioned. And we would be removing companies in which we have a competitive advantage. And anybody who's involved with international trade will tell you it's pretty hard to find something you can do better than somebody else. And it's particularly hard for a high-cost economy like this one. And we do not have low labour costs. And it's hard for us to find things we're good at. And these companies would be perfectly viable and remain competitive and make money if everybody had a carbon, if everybody priced carbon. So if everybody in the globe had an emissions trading scheme, these companies would not be in the circumstances they're in. There's another reason why I think you should be concerned about these companies. I spoke about some of the industries they're in: petrol, refining, cement, steel. We're not going to do without these commodities. I don't see in the short term that Australia could survive without access to having quantities of cement or quantities of motor spirit or quantities of steel. So if these companies become uneconomic and have to close, what we're going to do is we're going to import those things. We're going to buy them off somebody else. And given the region of the world in which we sit, it's most likely that they'll come from countries which have far less stringent environmental standards than we do. So what Australia will be doing is actually exporting its pollution. We'll do absolutely nothing for global pollution. And remember, we're only 1.6% of CO2 emissions. So what we're trying to do here is deal with a global problem by persuading others. And I don't think we're going to do that very well if we export. We achieve our CO2 reductions by shifting them into Indonesia or China or somewhere else in Asia. And that's what's called carbon leakage, if you ever hear the term utilised. So carbon leakage doesn't really achieve the objective. So therefore, forcing these companies out of business doesn't really do anything for the environment, costs jobs in Australia, and sees a significant destruction of Australia's export capacity. Let me move on just quickly to say something about the electricity sector. The electricity sector, as I mentioned at the beginning, is the biggest single emitter of CO2, largely because of Australia's predominance of coal-fired electricity generation. And the electricity sector, if it's going to meet the sort of reductions in CO2 that are being contemplated, and let's talk about one number that's been suggested, which is that Australia should reduce its CO2 emissions by 10% by 2020 over the level that applied in 2000, I think is the number. Yep. If you actually build into that equation the fact that it's not a static situation, Australia's population is going to continue to grow between now and 2020. What you're talking about is not a 10% reduction, it's actually a 34% reduction in business as usual. So compared to what they would have emitted had they made no changes, you're looking for a 34% reduction in carbon emissions by the electricity sector. Now, the only way you're going to get that sort of a reduction is to do two things. All of the new capacity you add has to be low emission, and you actually have to replace some of the coal generation with low emission technologies. Now, when you actually sit down and start trying to figure out where does this come from, what replaces coal generation and what sources of electricity generation will be added, what you find is that the requirement is quite massive. You have to have a very, very substantial step up in gas generation because gas is one of the technologies that is mature. It's well proven. It's clean. However, in order to generate electricity from gas at the level that would be required, we would also need to develop new gas fields. So Australia would require to have new sources of gas to bring on stream. Now, that's perfectly possible. I'm not suggesting for a second you can't do that. You can do that. However, gas can't meet all of the requirement. You also have to significantly expand wind power, and you have to expand it by something like a factor of six. So you have to find six times as many opportunities to generate wind-powered electricity as we have today. Now, that in itself poses some real technical problems because the number of sites available that you can use to generate electricity from wind are limited, and many of them are quite remote. And once you get into remote sites, you've got an issue in transmission because electricity loses as you transmit. So there's a massive investment required in transmission. Now, when you put all this together, what it tells you is the electricity industry has to be prepared in the 10 years from 2010 to invest about $4 billion a year for each of the 10 years. And that is a level it has not invested in recent times. Now, it's not to say it's impossible. It's not impossible. It could conceivably do it. But you've got to put that against a backdrop that it's going to be asked to do that at a time when the value of its existing assets, its existing coal generating stations, has significantly declined as a result of the carbon price. So an industry where you're going to come along and say, I'm going to make your current business worth a lot less, and by the way, I want you to spend $4 billion a year for each of the next 10 years, you begin to see why you might have a problem in persuading the industry to do that. And that's why the argument is on the table that in order to assist the industry to make that transition, you need to provide some support. Now, the Business Council has not put a proposition on the table in relation to how that support should work. I think that's a matter for the electricity industry. We're simply highlighting the fact that what they're being asked to do in making that transition is quite a significant task, and we believe they do need some assistance. Let me just make a couple of other minor points before I sum this up. There will be some modelling by the Australian Government Treasury become available towards end of October or sometime in October. And Treasury will do some very high-level macroeconomic modelling of the whole of the economy. Now, I don't want to prejudge what the Treasury modelling will tell us. That's not appropriate. But there is a significant difference between the sort of work we've done here and what they are doing. We've been looking at individual companies. They're looking at the totality of the economy over a longer time period. And it's highly likely in that modelling that there will be an underlying assumption that if industries go out of business, over the 10 years, new industries will come in to replace them. And I'm not disputing that whatsoever. But what that modelling will probably not show us clearly is what I would describe as the dislocation effects, i.e. the effects of companies going out of business, people losing their jobs, and they're having to be retrained and find their ways into new industries. And also, I reiterate, if these energy-intensive, trade-exposed industries go out of business, we are losing industries in which Australia is competitive. And it's not easy to find industries in which you have a competitive advantage. I'd also make the statement that I made earlier, just to reinforce it. Even in the propositions that the Business Council has put on the table to assist these companies, there's still a fair amount of pain associated with the implementation of ETS. We are not proposing that industry gets a free ride. Matter of fact, the assistance mechanism we put on the table suggests to us that that industry could well experience a decline in their earnings of somewhere between 6 and 9%. And that's not insignificant. And you can put it in context by thinking about what happens to companies who announce those sort of reductions. Those companies will have to look very hard at how they can accommodate that. But we believe it is going to be a case that industry will have to take part of the burden, but not to the point where you drive those companies out of business. The last point I want to make is about the political dimension. This is unquestionably, in my view, the most important decision that the Rudd government will make in its first term. It is an absolutely critical decision for Australia. It's bigger than the GST, and its ramifications are much greater than the GST. And one of the things that anybody in business doesn't like is uncertainty. Because in an uncertain environment, you have to make estimates, and chances are you probably make more pessimistic estimates than you might otherwise do. And what we need to try and get into the final design of an emissions trading scheme is political support from both parties. We need this to be a bipartisan thing which is supported both by the government and the opposition, because it would not be any good, in my view, it would not be desirable, in my view, for us to have a situation where we get the design of a scheme and then we're waiting for an election to find out whether the next party coming into power will determine to introduce something completely different. Now, it has happened in Australia. There has been bipartisan support for things like monetary policy. And the benefit of that has been lower interest rates than we might otherwise have seen. And we believe that if you can get a bipartisan position on climate change, then we'll get a much stronger Australian economy. So let me now just try and sum up what I've been saying for the last 20 minutes or so. We think it's really important that there is a discussion in the community about how much cost do we as a nation want to bear by deciding to be a first mover in climate change and introduce an emissions trading scheme. Because that cost is going to be borne by the community. There's no question about that. I mean, business doesn't have some magic capacity just to absorb costs. those costs ultimately get passed through to consumers. And in this case, because Australia is a significant exporter and an exporter in industries which are energy intensive, part of that money is going to go to consumers offshore, which we're going to have to subsidise some of those companies in the short term to remain in Australia. Now, both the government and business agree. There's no dispute on the government's part that you are going to have to provide that assistance. And that's the second issue in terms of how do you actually deliver that. And the research we've done suggests that the methodology set out in the Green Paper has some very severe and unintended consequences. I don't believe for a second the government set out to say, let's have this happen. And that is exactly why I put a Green Paper out, to have just the sort of discussion that that is being raised. However, when you come to that balance between how much money do you give to assist industry and how much is left to compensate the consumers, you're very much back into the debate about what cost the community as a whole wants to bear. And that is an issue which is not without its political challenges. We have in our paper, and if you do want to read through to the end of it, we've actually put some suggestions on the table as to how you might balance these issues and come up with something that that will achieve what the government wants to do, which is reduce emissions, keep the economy strong, and create a global example. And it's partly about how quickly you choose to move ahead of our competitor nations, because the quicker you move, the harder the problem is to solve. We believe that Australia should tackle climate change. We believe that an emissions trading scheme is the right way to go about it. And we think the community needs to have a very clear and sensible debate about that. Business has a very important role to play in this whole issue, and we want to play that role. Thank you.
Many thanks. Greg Galley, and many thanks again to Minta Ellison for the use of this facility. And so we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7, and we'll start now. So can I start first up, and I'll go to Geoffrey Norman. The comments you made about the report were very important of your recent project research. Why do you think those kind of issues were not picked up in the Garnaut report or the Green Paper?
Certainly Ross Garnaut identified the issue on emissions intensive trade exposed industries, and he fully agrees that that they need to be assisted. He described it as a dreadful problem, because this, you've got this issue, the more you give them, the less you've got to compensate the consumers, and that's the really difficult political issue. They were picked up in the Green Paper. What we're saying, though, is that the mechanism that's in the Green Paper doesn't achieve the objective the government set about. And then there is the second problem about how high you set the carbon price and how much stress or how much cost you place on the economy as a whole. Until such time as others move. I mean, I just qualify everything I'm saying here. If there was a carbon price of $20 or $40 or $100 or whatever number you want to pick, and it was right across the board in all countries, there's no debate. There's no issue here. The only issue that you then got to deal with is the one of what it might do to your standards of living if you suddenly impose a $100 carbon price.
Jeffrey,
I'm going to reframe the question slightly that I was going to ask. What you described sounds not unlike a carbon tax, in that you pay for a permit and then you emit, whereas a tax, you'd emit and then you'd pay the tax on it. Certainly, bearing in mind the significant scientific uncertainty, notwithstanding what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says, they made some absurd claims regarding malaria, for example, and there is a lot of scientific uncertainty which they don't admit, and which is outside the debate here, I might stress. But a tax is very easy to repeal. You just simply tell the emitters you're no longer going to pay the tax. What we've been talking about here is an emissions trading scheme, which doesn't sound to me to be all that different from a tax, and perhaps you might like to explain how an ETS might differ from a carbon tax.
Yeah, look, sure, absolutely. And a carbon tax was one of the options that was on the table and was certainly discussed by the government and by anybody else that's been involved in the debate. The easiest way, I think, to encapsulate the difference between a carbon tax and an emissions trading scheme is the carbon tax falls on everybody. In other words, everybody pays the carbon tax who happens to be emitting. But if Scott's an emitter and Katie's an emitter, the attraction of they both pay the carbon tax. The attraction of an emissions trading scheme is they both have to buy permits for every tonne they emit, but you can trade the permits. And if Katie puts more value on being able to emit to the environment, then she'll buy permits off Scott, and Scott will sell them to her. So it creates a trading opportunity of the right to emit, which in economic theory would say that those that have the biggest need for them, i.e. the most difficulty in actually reducing their emissions, will be the ones who ultimately will pay the highest price for the carbon permit. So it's designed to be more, I guess, efficient or more selective and encourage people to reduce their emissions, and those people that can't are the ones that will have to buy more permits. Because the number of permits declines over time.
Okay, Trevor, then we go to the person in front of Trevor, then we go down here. Yeah, okay. We've got plenty of time. Now, we don't have a lot of time, so I know you'll be brief, Trevor, you will, but...
No, I won't. Is the Business Council aware, because you don't seem to have had much scientific backup before you came to your decision, of the views of David Evans, who was the consultant to the Australian Greenhouse Office from 1999 to 2005, and he was the fellow who actually built the carbon accounting model that measures Australia's compliance with the Kyoto Protocol. And he has now recanted his views and says it's all nonsense. In the article in the Australian of, I think, this August 1, I was travelling internationally at the time, so I don't know sure.
Trevor.
Since 1999, new evidence has seriously weakened the case that carbon emissions are the main cause of global warming. And by 2007, the evidence was pretty conclusive that carbon played only a minor role and was not the main cause of recent warming anyway. He goes on to
say
he doesn't believe in it. Why should the Business Council of Australia take such a weak-kneed approach towards this? Why should we have emissions trading at all?
Okay. Right. Well, look, those views are perfectly fair and reasonable for you to have. The reality we're dealing with here is that is a decision by the government, and the government has made that decision, and what the Business Council is trying to do is work with the government to get a scheme which achieves their objectives. Now, if carbon trading is not something we should be dealing with, that's an issue for the politicians, quite frankly. I don't see that the Business Council can arrive at that position. We don't have the technical knowledge to understand the science, and that is a decision for politicians. So I would suggest you should raise that issue with the politicians.
I'm doing that.
Question here.
Yeah. Yes, you didn't touch on this, I think, but the scheme itself seems to me will be a bureaucratic nightmare to actually implement. On the one hand, companies will have to account for every tonne of carbon they emit. Presumably the government will check on whether they're being honest or not. So that's a cost impost that you haven't mentioned, which I would imagine would be very considerable, so I'd like to comment on that. Second point, if we had an orderly introduction of nuclear-powered power stations in Australia, it seems to me that with three or four nuclear stations, we would easily meet the targets that have been set without the recourse to this cost impost on business and the community. So why isn't the Business Council pushing nuclear power?
The first part of the question, there is already reporting of major emitters under the NG National Greenhouse.
NGDR.
Thank you. I knew it was NG something. So major emitters are already reporting to the government. They're a level. However, And I said this was a very complex area and issue. You know, there's lots of facets of complexity. The process of measuring those emissions is open to a degree of subjectivity in some cases. The government does propose an auditing process because, absolutely, if you're going to have to buy permits, then the government will want to audit, just as it audits your tax return. And there is a proposition whether the government chooses to go down the path or not, but there has been discussion about some sort of independent agency like the Reserve Bank, which would be facilitate the sale and management of the scheme. But it clearly is going to be bureaucratic. It requires a bureaucracy, and that's why a bit of the money goes off in the churn factor of collecting it and leaving it. As far as the nuclear debate is concerned, look, again, all I can say is that's a political question. And neither side of politics at this point seems prepared to embrace nuclear power generation. So that's something that I think the community has to decide.
Question here.
I was just wondering, and I'm not expecting the other answer to this, but you did mention that until such time as others do, from an international perspective. I was wondering if the BCA considered what that might look like.
Well, again, I mean, the issues that are being raised are political issues. I think the challenge for Australia is how do we come up with a scheme that clearly gets us in a first mover position, but doesn't take us too far out ahead of the competition, such that we damage our economy, and that's a real challenge politically. But that's what I think for the BCA's money, that's what we're saying you need to do. But that's a debate the community has to have.
Ian, you've got to be briefer than this.
My question is, why go with successful? The second point is, this has a very good effect on the ability of Australian companies to innovate with this cost to bring new technologies. In fact, the system you're proposing is going to slow up that process.
Okay, we've got it. Right.
Okay, well, I wouldn't agree with you. First of all, we're not even taking a position in terms of saying what Australia should do. We put a couple of options on the table and say, if you wanted to do and live within some of the conflicting objectives you set, you can take this route. But if Australia chooses and the government decided tomorrow to apply a carbon price of $100 a tonne, which might take you towards the sort of aggressive trajectory that you are intimating, what we're saying in our research is, what will happen in that scenario, like it or not, and we don't like it, is that many of these companies will simply migrate offshore, and that will not reduce global carbon. So you don't even achieve your objective, and you impose a huge impost on the community. Because the cold hard reality is, these companies are competing in a global market with a price that they do not control. Now, you can shake your head, but it's the reality of life. I mean, I happen to be a director of Caltex. Now, if Caltex faced $100 a tonne carbon, then based on the calcs we've seen, that would push the price of petrol up by about 20 cents a litre. Now, if Woolworths then turned around and said, tomorrow I can buy it from Singapore and I don't have to pay the 20 cent impost, you can imagine what will happen to the refinery at Kurnell. It would disappear. It would be uneconomic on day one. So that's the kind of impact that you would see in this country. So the refinery in Singapore would pump out a lot more petrol and a lot more carbon emissions, and we would cease manufacturing in Australia with all the defence, security of supply issues, job issues that that entails. Now, you may not like that comparison, but that's the way it is, which is why the real prize here is persuading other countries to go with us. And I don't believe anybody will follow us if the example we set is one where we have significantly damaged our economy.
Jump the back and then come down here. Yeah.
Well, I think that's why the design of this scheme is so important, and why there needs to be a very active debate to try to pull all the information together, and why we would say, however, again, I stress it's a decision for the government, we would say you should start slow and get your feet and find out which way it's heading before you rush in and apply a $100 price on carbon.
The trade exposure part of the emissions intensity trade. Do you know why, from your discussion with government, they've basically whipped out on differentiating between various degrees of trade exposure and just assumed that the whole economy, unless there's a barrier, is trade exposed? Because clearly different industries have different degrees of trade exposure.
That's absolutely correct. And even within industries, different parts of companies have trade exposure. If you take steel as an example, the manufacture of steel is almost certainly trade exposed. The retailing of steel goods within Australia, which is carried out by the companies that manufacture steel, is not trade exposed in the same way. In other words, if they cease to manufacture and import it, they still retail and sell throughout the economy. So the focus for assistance is very much on the facilities within the industry that are trade exposed. That's one element of it. There's another element which I think you're alluding to, that a vast number of Australian companies are trade exposed, depending how you want to categorise it. You could argue that the hotel I'm staying at tonight is trade exposed because if it puts rooms rates up too much, people will go somewhere else. But you've got to draw the line somewhere, and those companies do have other factors which generally drive their prices, like in the hotel's case, the quality of the hotel, the ambiance. There isn't much quality and ambiance attached to a litre of petrol or a tonne of steel. It's a harder product to get a margin above the global price. Caltex is absolutely better. And it was proven by, I think it was today tonight.
There's a question here. We've got to be brief now. We're coming to the end. Yep.
We had an announcement last week about the introduction of geothermal power. Surely that makes an immense amount of sense and will reduce the need for subsidising and coal burning power stations. Comments, please.
I can't comment on the specifics of. I think you're referring to the Worley Parsons solar? No, something else. Okay. Okay. I can't comment because I don't know the details. But look, they're the sort of the low emission technologies you've got to move to, and the issue there is the cost of generation versus coal fired, and the degree to which that difference exists. But sorry, I can't comment.
I'll tell you about wind power.
Not tonight, sir.
Yeah. Just a comment, more or less. Coal is really Australia's comparative advantage in this global sort of bet that we've got ourselves into. I don't think we should get up the fight at all on coal. I think we've got to do a lot more on coal before we do any of this compromising our economy or pushing up the price of things and things like that. I'd like to see all the effort go into better managing the coal resources that Australia has to produce the energy that we need.
Well, certainly carbon storage is a huge prize. Whoever comes up with the methodology to make it work, whether it's this country or somewhere else, there's a huge economic prize for them in doing it.
If we are successful as a first mover on this project, are we able to pull back some of the offset in terms of exporting the intellectual property to other countries that might have followed? Have you looked at that?
Well, I mean, that's part of the government's rationale in taking some of the permit revenues and putting it into research and development. And I said at the beginning that we just don't see negatives. We see positives in the sense there will be a business opportunities arise out of climate change and emissions trading. But I think you've got to be realistic and say that those opportunities will probably come relatively slowly, and they'll certainly come a lot slower than the impost on your business the moment that there's a price on carbon. but we don't underestimate the ability to come up with new business opportunities out of this process.
How do you think the voting population of Australia is going to become well enough informed about this matter to either support a government that wants to do it or support one that doesn't want to do it?
I think it is a huge challenge to do that, and I think that the primary things that will swing the population as a whole in the debate is where what's been the influence to date, which is a lot of publicity about global warming and the adverse effects of it and the fact we're in a drought and it's not raining and I can't water my garden in Melbourne and various things like that, clearly create a perception out there that this is a problem and we need to address it, and I think that's clearly one element of the public debate. I think there's another element which we'll begin to see when the scheme comes into place and prices start going up and people begin to feel the economic impact of what's doing. Now, how you get that all put together in a sensible debate in the public arena is challenging, because this is a very complex, difficult area.
Just on this issue of climate change, to what extent is the Business Council a regulator versus an educator?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
You're a regulator or an educator, but you're not a regulator.
We're not a regulator. I mean, what we're trying to do is, the government's put a proposition on the table. The work we've done in essence says this doesn't work because the mechanism you've got for assisting industry, and I could go into the details but we haven't got time, doesn't work. You have to change it. And you can change it and not increase the amount of money. That's one debate. And the second debate is how much pain do you put into the industry sector? And what are the consequences of that? And the second thing we're saying is if you make that pain sufficiently great, those companies will migrate offshore and you will actually achieve nothing in terms of reducing carbon.
Final great question.
Thank you, Vera West. One thing made me feel a little bit uncomfortable, and that was about having bipartisan support. You said this is one of the biggest decisions facing Australia as a nation. Don't we need to encourage vigorous debate rather than political expediency?
Well, I think there was and has been a fair amount of debate in the area I'm not entering into, which is do you need to address carbon change, carbon climate change, and we've seen how much difference of opinion there is in this room, let alone anywhere else. And both parties at this point in time are supporting an emissions trading scheme. That was also the policy of the opposition. That was the policy of the Howard government. However, the characteristics of the scheme are quite different. And what we're looking for bipartisan support in is the design of it, so that at least everybody agrees this is what we're going to have and this is how it's going to work, and not run the risk that when government changes, someone will come in and turn the actual mechanism over on its head.
Many thanks. Take that seat.
We had an important paper and a lively discussion tonight, and we could have gone on longer, but it's right on 7 o'clock and we finish on time. As I was listening to Mr. Gowley, I was just reflecting, and I'll be very brief, of what it was like about two decades ago before the formation of the Business Council of Australia. And over the last two decades, and a bit beyond that, in a number of areas, the BCA has made a very important contribution to the public debate. Of course, it's not the government. Obviously, it doesn't make decisions, but it makes representations to politicians and to those who govern us. And what we've seen tonight from Mr. Gowley is a BCA president who can talk in a way that people who are not specialists in business or in energy policy or in science can understand, can get across a message, and has heading an organisation that's doing a lot of very significant work. So we've had a significant address here tonight. I'm sure these matters will be discussed for many years to come. But for tonight, I'd just like to say many thanks to Greg Gowley. Well done.
Thank you.
And again, thanks to Minter Ellison, and we'll see you all again next time. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.